tonight. The forecast now from the National Weather Service, partly sunny and warm, 40% chance of rain, most likely late in the afternoon, high of 83. More showers and thunderstorms tonight, a low of 65, 50-50 chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, a high of 79. Right now, humidity 83%, a little sticky, 72 degrees at 8:10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm going to be privileged to speak with Dr. Steven Pinker, who is the Johnstone Professor of Psychology at Harvard University and the author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank Slate. In this particular case, we're going to be talking about Professor Pinker's book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is Professor Pinker's contention that even amidst the headlines which trumpet violent acts each and every day, we in fact live in a world that is much less violent than it once was. And in his sprawling book, almost 700 pages long, Professor Pinker lays out a number of different respects in which violence in fact has declined over the millennia, over the course of centuries, and over the course of recent decades as well. Violence as it plays out in a number of different respects, on larger canvases between countries, and on a smaller, more intimate scale, between individuals. In almost every respect, violence has been declining in dramatic ways. And he sees this as not a reason to be complacent, but as a cause for hope, that we have accomplished so much in terms of reducing violence, and we can do still better to make our world an even more peaceful place. The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, is now a paperback from Penguin Books. Professor Pinker, you say very early in the book that in raising the whole notion of us living in a less violent world than it once was, that this is an idea that invites skepticism, incredulity, and sometimes anger. Say a word about that, and maybe some actual experiences that you have had in stating this, in terms of how such a notion has been received, and what that has done to your firmness of conviction.
Yeah, there certainly has been incredulity, particularly in conversations with the news media, because it's just easy to say, well, what about the shooting that happened this morning, or the terrorist attack last week, or the bombing the week before? And I have to reply by saying, well, it's true that rates of violence have not gone down to zero, And as long as violence hasn't been wiped off the face of the earth, which I think will never happen, there'll always be enough events to fill the news. What you have to do is look back to how much violence there was in the past, and it's only when you do that that you appreciate something that the news could never show you, which is that the rates have come down, because news is about things that happen, not about things that don't happen. And if we don't count up the number of schools that have not been shot up, or the number of countries that are at peace, or the number of people who come home to their families and aren't mugged or shot or raped, then we can lose the bigger picture. So I have to counter people's simple disbelief that this could possibly be true by saying, look, I'm going to show you a graph, and you can see it with your own eyeballs. But until you look at the graph, if all you do is remember the headlines, then it can just seem unbelievable. There's also some anger because people think that if you point out to things getting better, then you must be callous about the violence that's taking place now. But I argue that it's the opposite. If you are just resigned to the fact that rates of violence are always going to be the same, that human nature doesn't allow us to lower violence, then you can say, well, why even bother? People will just kill each other no matter what you do. And I try to hold out the fact that violence has gone down as a reason to try to drive it down even farther. That and to my own surprise, actually, when I came across these data, you know, in the 1960s, there were folk songs saying, I had a dream that the world put an end to war. And it's easy to laugh at that and think, oh, that's just kind of romantic haze from taking too many mind-altering drugs in the 60s and too much love and peace and folk songs. But then when you look at the numbers and you see that wars between countries really have been going down, and it's actually not a crazy dream to think that war in the old-fashioned sense of country A declaring war against country B could be eliminated in the same way that we've eliminated slave auctions and dueling and crucifixions and all kinds of awful stuff that people thought would always be with us. So that's how I counter the anger that if you say that violence has gone down, that means that you're indifferent to the violence that still takes place.
Right. You say at one point in the book that this topic has inspired, in your words, too much piety and not enough understanding. What would be some of the ways in which this has been most true and in your view, least beneficial?
Yes. Certainly giving huge coverage in the news to a particular event, a terrorist attack, a police shooting, and not putting it in the perspective of trends in the past, of reminding people of the horrific wars that they tend to forget. I mean, does anyone talk about the war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s, or the Chinese Civil War, or even the war in Vietnam, which is about 10 times as damaging as the war in Iraq? I think it is crucial to look at the numbers and to say, what has gone right? Let's figure out what has worked. Let's try to do more of it.
I think that's what you're talking about when you say that one thing is that what we need to do in approaching this is with an unsentimental sense of history and with statistical literacy. And, of course, that's a couple of things that not all of us are all that good at.
Yeah, it's for two reasons. One of them is just in terms of emotional energy. Is it even worth it to try to eliminate war, to try to reduce the threat from nuclear weapons, to try to make the streets safer? Or are you just being a romantic or a utopian? If you read the papers, you might think, oh, why even bother? It's just throwing money down a rat hole. People are going to kill each other no matter what you do. And that's wrong. It's just an incorrect belief. And then the other is how. What works? What doesn't work? And that, of course, is the most moral thing to do, is you prevent people from getting killed and raped and assaulted and maimed. And that's why there's a moral imperative to understand.
You really help us take in this notion of us living in a less violent world by spelling it out in a number of different ways, including six different trends of de-escalating violence. And could you just touch on these? Because I think in just doing so, our listeners will have at least a notion of just how thoroughly you are exploring this question.
Yeah, it's important to separate out different kinds of violence because they really did go down on different timelines. And you can get, it's easy to get confused if you don't keep track of the different categories, because war isn't the same thing as a stabbing in a bar. You look at, say, World War II, which was the most violent event in history, and you say, well, the 20th century must have been the most violent century ever. And that isn't right, because in general, more people are killed in homicides than in wars, and the rate of homicide has been going down since the Middle Ages in parts of the world where we have continuous data. War really only started to go down after World War II. Before that, there were fewer wars, but the wars that did take place killed more people, so the world wasn't actually getting better. But in the last 72 years, we've seen the trend go down for war much more recently. Then a third category was violence that was allowed by law. Slavery, for example, where if a slave escaped, the government would help round him up and bring him back. Capital punishment for shoplifting or for poaching or for counterfeiting. The government was the one killing people. And starting around the Enlightenment, the late 18th century, at the time of the Bill of Rights of our own country, then you started to see red lines that governments couldn't cross. Governments couldn't cut off body parts or torture people. It took a little bit longer to abolish slavery, but the abolitionist movement began in the late 18th century. So that's yet a third timeline. I call it the humanitarian revolution, and that gets its own chapter in the book, separate from the chapters on war and on homicide.
So there are a number of different ways in which violence has actually decreased over the centuries, over the millennia. Your book also explores some of the reasons for this. And in doing so, you explore some of the demons which tend to drive violent behavior, but also what you call the four better angels of our nature, quoting, of course, our 16th president. Touch on what those are and the kind of difference those have made.
Yes, the better angels of our nature, which is a lovely poetic description of brain science and psychology, namely parts of human nature that pull us back from violence, include empathy, that is the ability to feel others' pain and to think about what it must be like in their shoes, but also self-control, since a lot of violence is impulsive. The anger wells up and you just have to act on it, but pushing back against that is the part of the brain that makes you think twice and hold your horses and count to 10. Then there's also reason, rationality, thinking. That is, of all of the policies that we could implement, which are the ones that could actually do the most good, that could reduce the murder rate, reduce the likelihood of getting into a war? And so you can calculate your way to a better world as well.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, and what I think has changed over the course of history is not that we've become a nicer species. Evolution doesn't work that quickly. We're still the same people biologically that we were 70 years ago and 100 years ago and 500 years ago. But we've changed the rules of society so that the better angels of our nature are more influential.
So why is it, and is it true, but I think it's true that when violence occurs, when it does break out, even if it is statistically less frequent, why does it seem to have such enormous impact and resonance with us? And is that the way it should be? I mean, are we overreacting to the violence that does exist in our world?
Yes and no. Part of the reason that violence has gone down is that we care more about categories of victims of violence that we didn't care about in the past. Violence against racial minorities, wars in parts of the world that it's easy for us to forget about in Africa, in the Middle East, in the Far East. Just as a simple example, the fact that bullying is now a major category of violence, that would have been unthinkable when I was a boy. Bullying was just a part of childhood, and you'd be a sissy to worry about it. Now we legitimately think about what it's like to be a child who is constantly picked on. So that is good. On the other hand, if violence is covered indiscriminately, then that kind of creates an opportunity for violence entrepreneurs to kind of game the system and to manipulate the news media, which is a bad thing. And the two categories where that happens are terrorism, where terrorism doesn't really kill a whole lot of people, but it is a media manipulation tactic. It's a way that people with a grievance can get the world's attention by killing a few innocent people in a spectacular way, and then they get the world's attention. And something is similar probably for rampage shooters, for the guy who gets a gun and shoots up a school or a movie theater or a sports playing field. Not a whole lot of deaths, but because there's wall-to-wall coverage, it actually creates an incentive for those people to get the world's attention.
One of the most striking sentences in your whole book is when you say, "Nostalgia for a peaceable past is the biggest delusion of all in which we can engage." And that's a way for you to segue into, I think, one of the most important points in your book, which is that if we can accept this amazing notion that we live in a less violent world than we once did, that also makes it possible for us to embrace modernity, this modern world, this modern life, in the face of what is often very easy criticism and lazy criticism that can be lodged against it.
Indeed, we have to think back to the world in which countries competed against each other and went to war over national greatness, which killed people by the tens of millions, and not get distracted by acts of terrorism, which kill people three or four at a time.
Your book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is a New York Times bestseller, now available in paperback from Penguin Books, the author, Steven Pinker. Professor Pinker, thank you so much for this opportunity for me to speak with you about your endlessly fascinating book.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
And the time is exactly 8:28. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program. It is always exciting when we can have a morning show conversation about something that we utterly take for granted or do not stop to really deeply ponder. How about something as pervasive, as ordinary as our names? Why is it that each of us is given a name? Why is it that we have a first and a middle and a last name? Why is it that the tradition emerged for the woman when she marries to take on the name of her husband? Why is it that in certain times in our history or certain places in the world, people were identified by one single name, Aristotle? Where did that tradition come from? There are all kinds of fascinating questions to explore about the whole phenomenon of naming. And it is explored so beautifully in a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. The author of the book is Mavis Himes, a PhD psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist based in Toronto. And she has written about this interesting facet of human existence in very intriguing fashion, in part from the perspective of her own Jewish faith, but the book certainly goes beyond that as well, and touches on many, many different traditions and legacies. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's called The Power of Names. And Mavis Himes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the show.
I'm really interested to be talking with you. I think somebody at a glance might be intrigued by the fact that a clinical psychologist is writing such a book. Can you just say a word about how your own professional expertise and field of interest intersects with something like the phenomenon of how we are named?
Certainly. I wear two hats. I wear a clinical psychology hat, and I also wear a hat as a psychoanalyst. And it's really through that door that this book or this topic came to me. You know, we come into this world as no different than animals, in a sense, we could say. We're a bundle of biological, you know, nerve endings and anatomical structures. And it's only when we are named, and in fact we are called into being, as I would say, that we become human. And so it's this aspect of being animated and infused with life through our name. We're the only species that names. And it's interesting how when you have a pet, you also name the pet because they become like part of the family and human as well. So there's something about when names don't take. And in my work as a psychoanalyst, I sometimes see cases where the name really becomes a bit of a metaphor for problems because the name is connected to who we are and to our past, etc. So it's through that, really. Right.
In some ways I have a very unremarkable name, and yet there's something remarkable about it in that my full name is, and probably most listeners to the morning show have no idea, my full name is David Gregory Berg.
Uh-huh.
But my parents, right from the start, called me Greg, and the reason was because they had relatives in Milwaukee with three successive generations of Ronald, and so you had Big Ron and Little Ron and Baby Ron, and even when Baby Ron is a college student, he's still Baby Ron to clarify which Ron are we talking about, and so they didn't want me to be Little David.
Right,
but they liked
right.
the way David Gregory Berg rolled off the tongue, so that is my full name, and the issue comes up again and again, and it's just kind of fun in a sense. I appreciate the fact that there's something about my name that's just ever so slightly out of the ordinary, and I think for me maybe it's made me a little more conscious of my name, or I think about exactly what my name is.
But what's so interesting and what's so typical in what you're saying is that as soon as I would mention this topic to someone, I would get exactly what you've just done. I would get a story about their name, whether they liked their name, they didn't like their name, whether the history of their particular name. And you also bring up a point that many people are named in certain traditions. The same name becomes, you know, Bob Senior, Bob Junior, Bob the First, Bob the Second, within a family, right? That we're named after some people, after family relatives or people, you know, within one family. In my tradition in Judaism, one can't name someone after a living member, and so you would only be named after someone who's deceased. And in that case, often it would be the second name, the middle name you'd be given of that relative. So it really varies with different cultures, the whole naming choice.
Right. I appreciate that your book, among other things, helps us to kind of delineate the nature of one's first name and one's last name.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That in a sense, one of them is one kind of statement, and the other is a very different statement about, in a sense, who we are and where we fit in the world and fit within our own family trees. Just say a word about that difference.
So. Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. Because the first name is really the, it satisfies a lot of the desires, expectations, fantasies of what a parent has for their child. So whether it's, I want my child to be so intelligent and named after a famous author, scientist, philosopher, or I want my daughter to be, you know, as beautiful as Elizabeth Taylor or Marilyn Monroe, and so I name her Elizabeth or Marilyn. And parents, I'm sure everyone listening realizes the amount of time and energy that goes into naming a child. And someone recently said to me, boy, it was such a huge responsibility. I was thinking, this little person that I'm bringing into the world is going to have to live with this name. So it's got to be, you know, a name that's so important. So that's the first name. And the second name is really carries our legacy. You know, it's our connection to our ancestors, to our lineage, and it's not a choice. We say the first name is a given. It's a donato. It's a gift. And the second name, the surname, is really, you know, carrying the lineage, as I say. Mm. And they each have different kind of psychological valence, really. Mm-hmm.
I like that. You also mentioned in the prologue something that I think is so important for framing this conversation. You write, most of us take our names for granted, yet our first name, both an introduction and a greeting, is one of the first words we learned. Assigned to us by our parents with love, it is freighted with their expectations and hopes for our future. Our surname, meanwhile, carries our collective history. It is a branding of transmission and affiliation, linking us to our ancestral past. But I love that fact that our first name is one of the first words any of us ever hear. And so in that respect, it is so integral to who we are from the first moment we're outside the womb.
And you bring a very important point by mentioning that, because the first name is given to us. And there is, it's not strongly pronounced in the book, but there is a theme that I feel is important, which is that the name is a house in which we live, but it's a word that's given to us. It comes from outside of us. And somewhere along the way, through life, our life journey, we have to appropriate that name and make it our home, from a house to a home, to something we inhabit, and that becomes our unique identity. Not only the expectations and fantasies of our parents, what they would like us to be, and not only the traditions of our ancestors, but somehow that we create out of our name. It's a kind of metaphor for who we are, in a sense. So I think that's really important. Yes.
I love that. And in the first chapter, which is called An Invitation into Being, I love the, in some ways it's maybe the slightest bit of a tangent, but I don't mean that at all critically. I love the moment you take to talk about an infant and hearing the sound of his or her mother's voice. Mm-hmm. And you write this, soon the infant will scan the musical notes of his mother's voice. These sounds will no longer be only a source of comfort or of emptiness, but also of information and signification. And very quickly, he will recognize those particular and distinctive sounds that form smoothly into a regular sequence. The labels that he hears and to which he responds become repetitive language patterns. And with increasing familiarity, he hears his own name as a melody of sweetness, or at times bitterness, to which he orients himself without hesitation. Conversely, the infant will also discover the power of his own sound. Within weeks, he will begin to recognize the impact of his own voice, his own cries, on the person who hears the cries as a call. The mother, interpreting the sounds of her infant as a demand for food, for comfort, for warmth, responds in haste, in panic, or in time, gradually attributing particular meanings to her baby's sounds. In this way, our little newborn will become a speaking being, a parletre, who will enter the world of desire and determination, drive and enthusiasm. His life will be honored and commemorated, lived with his named presence until its end.
Did I write that?
You did, beautifully. But I also love the way in which we think about how our name and our voice are, in a sense, intertwined, and it's difficult to think about one without the other.
Right, and think of how our name is pronounced in different situations. So you've got the voice and intonation of someone who's your partner, your life partner, your husband, your wife, your girlfriend, boyfriend, and how the melody and how those special terms of affection and how they pronounce our voice, as opposed to someone who's a stranger. And I think somewhere in there I indicate that sometimes in conversation, when people use our name over and over, and I gave the example of the car salesman, there's a kind of transgression for me, an overstepping of boundaries, because there's a familiarity in using our first name. We don't automatically use someone's first name. We often, you know, if it's a doctor, or it's a peer, it's okay. But a stranger who says, oh, Mavis, do you like this? Mavis, do you like that? Mavis, do you want? It feels like they're overstepping a boundary there.
Right.
That we don't have that relationship familiarity, and I don't want you assuming that you know me that intimately that you can automatically use my name repeatedly like that.
Right. You talk about the discomfort of a transgression, a line crossed without permission. To use someone's first name in casual conversation is to assume a particular relationship to that person.
That's right.
Do not enter such intimacy without implicit permission, nor are we always prepared to grant this privilege to others. Sometimes the familiar use of our name becomes a trespassing of boundaries. And of course, it's important then to understand, not just thinking about that particular transgression or offense, but just the fact that that says a lot about what our name is, I mean, and what our name creates for us.
That's right. It's interesting. It just made me, it's a bit tangential here, but, you know, in French or in Spanish, other languages, we have the two forms of addressing the you. You know, the familiar and the formal. So it's kind of using, in some case, it's a parallel to using that very intimate, informal use of the te form instead of the vous, and we usually ask permission. Mm. So I have patients who will say to me, can I call you Mavis, or are you Dr. Hines?
Mm.
You know, because one can't assume that relationship.
Absolutely.
Automatically.
We're speaking with Mavis Himes, who is the author of a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. I wonder if you could say a word about your own Jewish heritage, Jewish background, which, of course, is a very rich ground from which to draw when it comes to the matter of naming. And I mean, I happen to be Lutheran, so a lot of what you write about in this book are quite unfamiliar concepts, although some of them are, some of them we share. But I found some of this to be particularly fascinating, the importance of naming within the Jewish tradition. And at one point in the book, you even trace some of that importance back to the whole notion of a wandering people, a nomadic people.
Right. So that's a huge question, and I'm going to try and break it down into a few pieces. So my name, which you referred to as Mavis Himes, is the other piece of the impetus for this book, because it started with a certain awareness and working my own personal work on myself and who I am. And my father, who was Jewish, as you mentioned, and was one of nine siblings, seven of which were boys, decided at some point to change their name. The name was Himovich. So that's a very Jewish-sounding name, and growing up in Montreal after the war in the 40s, he and his siblings decided to anglicize, shorten the name, to make it to fit in more and not to draw attention to it. This is a very, very common experience, not only among Jewish people, but all many, many ethnic people who move to a new country and who want to eliminate the foreign-sounding, the ethnic-sounding part of their name. And there are studies even today that show that if you look at a list of people for job applicants or university applicants, in spite of thinking how pluralistic and liberal we are, those foreign-sounding names are less, have less chance of being accepted to the university or the job. So there's still that kind of prejudice when you hear a foreign-sounding name. Mm. So to get back to my story, so my surname was Haimovich. My first name, Mavis, was... I was named after my great aunt, my grandmother's sister, whose name was Malka, which is a Hebrew name. And often in the Jewish faith, we name, as I said, a child after a relative who's died. And because we don't necessarily keep the Hebrew name, because we have a Hebrew name and a secular name, we often name it after the first letter, so M, common to Malka, common to Mavis. But my Hebrew name is still Malka. And that Hebrew name is used in Jewish ceremony, weddings, burials, anything to do with the Jewish faith, any rituals, I would be called by my Hebrew name. And so my name conceals. It doesn't reveal. When people meet me, Mavis Himes, they have no idea what my ethnic background is. If I met you and I said, my name is Malka Haimovich, that has a completely different resonance. You would know immediately what my background was. So that's why I say the name announces. And through that, people often expect certain things. You meet someone with the name Annie Wong, you expect to meet an Oriental person, and yet this could be the surname of her partner or husband. And so we have preconceived notions just based on the sound of the name.
You know, it's so interesting as you kind of talk about the way in which many names are changed, and often people coming to this country might change their names ever so slightly and sometimes change those names quite dramatically.
Exactly.
And in many, many cases, there is no way to know exactly what was going through their minds. Was the name changed out of fear, mm-hmm. or was the name changed out of a sense of ambition? Or right. some kind of strange mix of those feelings and maybe others. I'd never stopped to think about how a real veil, a really impenetrable veil of mystery, probably surrounds that maybe most of the time. Probably most of the
and
time
many,
we don't know the answer to that question.
Yes, and many names go through transformations. And in your introduction, you mentioned the point that, you know, the Greeks had mononyms. They had one name. And it would be, Aristotle the something or other, or so-and-so the Stoic, or so-and-so the, and it could be a place name, a city name. And then the Romans had three names. But the Western world was mainly mononyms also. It was your first name, and those names typically were biblical names or names that had some relationship to a characteristic. They don't translate well in English. Joy, let's say. So may she bring joy or faith. Names that had a meaning, right? And then it was only in the 1700s when the pool of first names grew too big, and for taxation purposes, for civil purposes, the government needed to increase the pool of names, and surnames were added. And those who didn't own property, like the gypsies, the Jews, the disenfranchised, didn't have a surname until much later. That came much later.
Hmm.
So, and many people, as you say, Wanu, with these different surnames, want to fit into whatever community they belong in.
Right.
So there's a long history of name changing.
Absolutely.
Name changing, as you say, for to hide one's ethnic identity, but also many actors, many, artists, many change their name.
Right.
To sound more sexy.
Yeah. And I happen to be a music professor in my other life, a voice teacher with a background in opera. And one of the most intriguing reasons for an opera singer to change their name, once upon a time, I don't think it happens nowadays very often at all, but once upon a time, there would be American singers who would change their name into something that appeared to be Italian. So a soprano named Margaret Roberts would change her name to Margheriti Roberti.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, exactly.
And right. I think nowadays it doesn't happen because, generally speaking at least, American opera singers are among the best trained in the world. And so, you know, you're proud to be American in that respect at least. And that the last thing you would do is change your name to appear not American.
But it's a fascinating phenomenon. Right. And names go through phases, right? We also see that, especially first names, you know, they go in popularity. So the 60s had a lot of hippie names like Dawn and Aurora or, you know, Moonshine or, you know. And then there are trends that, you know, different trends. I'm not sure where we're at now. But I think people now want to search still for unusual sounding names.
Right.
The time when the pool was Linda, Susan, Barbara, Anne, you know, very, you know.
I am particularly fascinated by the phenomenon in modern America, in at least certain sectors of the African American community, where in many respects names are created that, at least as far as the parents are concerned, are utterly unique, and that is why they are created. I mean, specifically, so this is a name that no one else has ever had. Lequestrian, or whatever it might be.
Right.
And the more exotic sounding, the better. And
right.
I really wonder, and I imagine you wonder too, what is sort of the emotional or psychological hunger that is being satisfied?
Right. What immediately pops in my mind is perhaps the desire to be particularly unique as the name. And yet exotic as well, to kind of carry one's heritage in a prideful way, because if it's African Americans, there are people who've had a long history of, you know, slavery and disempowerment. So a kind of pride in saying, look, this is who I am, and at the same time a uniqueness. That, but pride comes to mind as well, you know, very. Much. That's off the top of my head. That's what I think of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Part two of your book is titled Burden or Blessing. And, of course, it talks about the fact that we feel, as you write at one point, an obligation to live up to our name, be it a name of fame or obscurity. For better or worse, we are all subjects of identification. And so, you know, whatever your, you know, if your last name happens to be Einstein or if your last name happens to be Hitler or whatever it might be. But there is this sense that we can be blessed by our name and we can be burdened by our name.
Right.
That's an intriguing concept.
Yes, and I think the burden part can be at what I would call a psychosocial level, like to carry a name like Hitler. I just read the biography of Stalin's daughter, written by a Canadian, and the struggle she had with her name, and at some point she marries and she moves to America and changes her name to Lana Peters. Svetlana was her first name, so it's taking the last few letters, and Peters was, Wes Peters was one of her many husbands. So the burden of that weighed at a kind of psychosocial level. But there's also the kind of deeper inner psychological burden of carrying a name that may have been fraught with abuse in one's family, a kind of need to distance oneself from some horrendous psychological abuse, if you want. And so that burden and the need to perhaps be identical, You know, if you carry a Kennedy name or Rockefeller, there's a whole prescription of how you should behave, as you mentioned. But I think psychologically, it also can be that kind of inner burden to want to create and fashion your own identity that's not so linked with that name that carries such a weight.
Hmm. I want to mention that there's also a chapter in the book, quite interesting, called In the Name of the Father, in which you talk about the matter that is so pervasive of the male name sort of carrying the weight. And, of course, we live in an age now where women are not nearly so prone to do that. Or I think of my own sister, who she and her husband, all through their wedding, I mean, during the ceremony, were still quietly whispering to each other about what their married name should be. And it was only towards the very end, before my father, who officiated, was finally told by one of them that we want our last name to be Spencer Berg, hyphenated.
Right.
But,
right,
I mean, right to the last possible moment, they were debating amongst themselves, which should it be? Should we hold our own, or what should we do? But
exactly.
Says something about how
huge. It's a very, very, today, you know, or for the last, you know, since the women's movement, I think that's been a huge issue. And that chapter you mentioned, In the Name of the Father, is probably the most psychological chapter for me and has some, you know, interesting concepts in it. But so again, I think there's always the question, who is the father? You know, we know the mother. We know the mother's carrying the baby in her belly. There's no question about who's the mother is. But there's always this deep-seated, unconscious question of who the father is, right? We never know. It's on faith that you think you know who the father is.
Or the result of a blood test that you would know,
right,
but there
right,
is no
right,
immediate
exactly.
visible way to know, oh, yes, this must be the father here.
Right.
Yes.
And even though we know, I mean, women know who the husband is most of the time, there's still this kind of lingering in one's unconscious, that doubt. And so that anecdote that I mentioned in the book where the husband says, or people say, oh, yeah, he's got, you know, daddy's eyes or daddy's nose, it's almost a sigh of relief. Yes, this really is my child. You know, thank God.
Absolutely. And there's so much to think about in the naming that we do in our lives. And my closing thought is my cousins from northern Minnesota, who all have two middle names. And just this morning, I wrote one of them. I said, how come all of you have two middle names instead of just one? And I'm expecting to hear that it's Episcopalian or it's some other, you know, ethnic reason. No, it was that the mom and dad argued about who the oldest child's middle name should be, so they just put them both down, and then they liked the way that sort of rolled out. So now they all have two middle names and beautiful names that they cherish, and it just spurs us on to think about our names and the importance of naming.
I'm so delighted that you were so taken with the book. That's very comforting and very reassuring.
It's a fascinating book. Again, it's called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called, published by Roman and Littlefield, and the author, Mavis Himes. Mavis Himes, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Take care.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, two different interviews. First, a preview of a fascinating documentary that comes from the Smithsonian Channel. It's called America in Color. It's actually a limited series. And the first installment, which is going to air this weekend, looks back at America in the 1920s, featuring extraordinary film footage, much of it never seen by the public before. And all of it very carefully and effectively colorized. I was just floored by how amazing this program was, and I speak with its executive producer on tomorrow's morning show. Also, we'll be talking about the Heritage Walking Tours of Downtown Racine, which occur under the auspices of the Racine Historical Museum. And we'll talk about that as well. On Monday's morning show, you'll hear my conversation with Dr. Jeff Thompson, who is CEO Emeritus of Gundersen Health System. And he has written a really interesting book called Lead True, in which he spells out some of his guiding principles in the way that he led the Gundersen Health System to a place of great prominence in the